produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's Normal's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from Normal. Our news today, schools spending already tight budgets on drug screening. Despite deep budgetary cuts to the federal program designed to grant funding for student drug testing, the practice of random drug screening continues at the expense of individual schools. In one such example, the Duluth News Tribune in Wisconsin recently reported that Duluth Superior High School has enacted a program to randomly test athletes, students with parking permits, and others in co-curricular activities. After-school programs such as debate or band are included. Another test group at the school is comprised of students who have volunteered for the tests and have pledged not to use drugs. Superior High School administrators estimate 60% of the students are involved in a co-curricular activity, which combined with the other test groups means a vast majority of Superior's student body will be subject to testing. Officials said between 10 and 15 students per week will be randomly chosen to submit a urine sample and take a breathalyzer exam. The school nurse will conduct testing with the results examined by an independent lab, which is expected to report back within 24 hours. 10 substances, including marijuana, methadone, amphetamines, barbiturates, cocaine, and alcohol, will be tested for, while steroids banned by the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association aren't part of the testing. With tests costing approximately $22.50 each, school administrators appropriated $15,000 from the 06-07 school year's administrative budget. That cost included purchasing a breathalyzer. Superior has applied for federal aid and is waiting to see if it receives any grant money. Superior's decision to enact the program in lieu of federal funding may point to a new trend, with an individual principal using funds from their school's already approved budget to fund a screening program. In most cases, school boards have implemented drug screening expenses and practices for entire school districts. Last week, the U.S. Department of Education, or DOE, dramatically reduced the level of funding available to subsidize random student drug testing programs in public high schools and middle schools, according to the agency's Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools. According to the agency, only $1.7 million in federal funds will be available for schools that wish to enact student drug testing programs in the 06-07 school year. Last year, the Department of Education subsidized student drug testing programs in 350 schools nationwide, at a total cost of more than $7 million. Despite the growing popularity of random student drug testing programs to date, the only federal study to assess the impact of student drug testing policies on a national basis found that, quote, drug testing as practiced in recent years in American secondary schools does not prevent or inhibit student drug use, close quote. We have links to more information about drug testing from the Normal Foundation at normalaudiostash.com. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today, I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America Action is a click away at norml.org. Thursdays here on The Stash, we focus on legal and legislative issues. And first, we have an interview with former Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper, conducted backstage at Hempfest with Vivian McPeak. Many thanks to THC TV, Vivian, and the Washington Normal Chapter for letting us air this piece today.
We are here at the 2006 Hemp Fest behind the main stage by the Hospitality Kitchen with the former Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper, author of the new amazing book, Breaking Rank. Norm, thank you so much for coming and supporting our message. It's so great to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's a delight to be here.
Well, you know, I've said it over and over at the fest. If somebody would have told us in 1991 that 15 years later the Chief of Police would be on our stage speaking our same message of freedom and responsibility, I'd have said you're crazy. But here you are. You know, it's amazing. What inspired you, you know, other than your experience as a police officer, I guess was the main thing, but really what inspired you to come forward and speak out like this so clearly?
I've got a number of passions that drive me, springing from my work as a police officer. At the top of the list, you know, looking at domestic violence and reorganizing police work and on and on and on, is social justice. It's just simply doing the right thing, being fair, being responsible. And along the way, showing a little compassion. And drug policy, drug laws, drug policy in this country fly in the face of that. So you got to speak out.
Yeah. I imagine that you've had probably a mixed reaction from the rank and file officer, especially the SPD. I imagine it's probably a mixture of complete support for your courage and your message, and also probably some that think you're a real turncoat. What would you say to the officers out there that might be watching about that?
Well, what I would say is for those of you who supported my position, thank you. For those of you who opposed it and told me that you did, thank you. What we need is a conversation.
A dialogue.
We're at an intersection, I think, at this time in our country. So many venues, events that I've attended in the last 10 or 15 years, in which the sponsors of these programs, federal programs, training for police chiefs and others, is like, we're going to talk about drug policy, but we're not going to talk about legalization, decriminalization, or any of that other nonsense. In other words, we're going to talk about how we can more aggressively prosecute this war. Well, those people who try that today oftentimes get shouted down. We're going to talk about it. We're going to have this conversation. I've reached a conclusion that the drug war is an abysmal failure. It's unwinnable. It's immoral. It's cost the taxpayers obscene amounts of money. But others who haven't come to that conclusion need an opportunity to discuss their doubts, their fears, their concerns. So it's all about dialogue right now.
You know, it's always blown our minds that anyone would consider prison less harmful on somebody than smoking marijuana. You know, that the logic just doesn't seem to be there.
Well, there is no logic there.
No, there isn't. And they don't want a dialogue, the people that want the status quo to happen, you know. Talk to us. You're a member of the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP, a great organization of all former and probably some current police enforcement.
We have a fair number of and growing number of current law enforcement officials. I should point out we also have some judges, sitting judges. We have correctional officers. We have probation officers, some prosecutors. It's a very strong and rapidly growing body of cops, ex-cops, and others in the justice system who believe that prohibition is a failed public policy and it has no hope for success in the future. So we are all about enlisting other people of like minds, and pleased to say that through our LEAP site, leap.cc, we can sign up new members, and we can also sign up friends of LEAP, people who will simply lend their names to the effort to reform this nation's drug policies.
Well, Norm, you were the chief of police when Seattle Hempfest started, and you all, and you know, and I was very aware at the time that you spearheaded community policing, which is a great great concept, you know, and how to approach policing within our communities. How aware were you of HempFest in 91, and what did you think about it when it started?
Well, in 91, I was still in San Diego.
Oh, that's right, you were.
And
so you weren't our chief when we started. It was right after.
I was not your chief.
So I've been wrong about that.
Until 19... Have you been speaking untruths?
That's not, the only one. Yeah,
not until 1994.
Okay, well then that's where we really got on the map.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one of the things that was so impressive to me was my cops coming back from HempFest having certain expectations going in with glowing reports of the friendliness, the support, the pats on the back that they got for working with your folks from the beginning, really. It's a desired assignment.
Wow. Well, you know, our condolences on the police officer that just lost his life. You may have seen that our security leads are all wearing black tape across their badges. And you know, I guess the thing that HempFest is the most proud of is our relationship that we've forged over the years with the law enforcement and all the first responders that we deal with, you know. And it's been aggressive diplomacy is what I like to call it. You know, mutual respect and cooperation and as much honesty as feasibly possible in this kind of environment, you know. So it's a thrill having you involved. It's on the highlights of my life to be here talking to you at HempFest and have you supporting us. You're so courageous. Thank you so much for stepping forward. I know that there must be elements of it. Like professionally, you had to make a real decision to change your career permanently to do this, you know. And I just want to say thank you so much. Thank you for serving our city and our country, you know, when you're a police officer, and now serving our country in a different way as an author and as a representative of the movement.
Thank you very much. Thanks for all you do.
All right, well, take care. You're on THC-TV, the Hemp Channel Television, with Norm Stamper at HempFest.
Thank you.
That was former Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper, now a speaker for law enforcement against prohibition, speaking with Vivian McPeak, the director of HempFest, backstage at Seattle's HempFest last weekend. Again, many thanks to Vivian, Washington Normal, and THC-TV for letting us use that piece today. Next up on the program is some independent music found up at podshow.com.
On Ryland Crescent for some blow. The room is full, but Stu's the only one I know. The smoker's rules require I stay around, at least for just one split. But then the bong it makes a round, soon I'm on my bed.
I get a little bit too stoned. I get a little bit too stoned. I get a little bit too stoned. I get a little bit too stoned.
Bloodshot eyes make contact briefly through the smoke. He smiles at me as though secretly I'm a joke. And then I realize that everyone is laughing at me now. Well, I just can't trust anyone. You know I need to leave somehow. Yeah. Cause I'm a little bit too stoned.
I get a little bit too stoned. I get a little bit too stoned. I get a little bit too stoned. I get a little bit too stoned.
Stu, you mate. Looking a little bit green.
Nah, he's a white mate.
He's just doing a whitey.
I want to leave but don't remember how I came. My legs declared their independence now from my brain. And as I hide behind my eyelids, conversing on my own, strangers stares bar into me, and so we'll pack another cone. Get myself just a little more too stoned.
I get a little bit too stoned. I get a little bit too stoned. I get a little bit too stoned. I get a little bit too stoned.
This temporary madness has taken hold of me, yeah. I guess I should be glad this will leave eventually. Some people, they have to 7 days a week, yeah. But luckily, that's not the case with me, because I'm just a little bit too stoned.
I get a little bit too stoned.
Too stoned.
I get a little bit too stoned.
A little bit too stoned.
I get a little bit too stoned.
Too stoned.
I get a little bit too stoned.
A little bit too stoned.
I get a little bit too stoned. I get a little bit too stoned. I get a little bit too stoned. I get a little bit too stoned.
That was some PodSafe independent music found up at podshow.com. We always have links to the individual artists and to PodShow itself right up at normalaudiostash.com. Next up today, we have our discussion about DUI with Normal Advisory Board member Dr. John P. Morgan. Normal's advisory board, legal committee, and state chapters represent one of the strongest grassroots information and education networks on the planet. It's a real privilege to present the voices of Normal on the Audio Stash every weekday. Joining us today on the Audio Stash is Dr. John P. Morgan, Professor Emeritus of Pharmacology at City University of New York, member of Normal's advisory board, and co-author with Lynn Zimmer of Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts. We have links to the book at normalaudiostash.com. Dr. Morgan has testified across the country on behalf of medical access to marijuana and recreational legalization. Dr. Morgan's background and current work make him the go-to source for our next topic, DUI. Dr. John P. Morgan, welcome to the Audio Stash today. It's a real privilege to have you with us.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
Dr. Morgan, these new DUI laws are fairly sweeping the nation. How have DUI laws changed, especially in the last few years?
Well, it's important to note initially that the movement in the last few years is not to impose DUI laws. It's to impose per se laws, that is, laws which do not require the examining of the arresting officer or the investigating officer to prove that you're driving under impairment. The laws are now constructed to prove you that you're driving with a drug on board you, not in the car, but in your body. So that for many, many years, opponents of marijuana normalization have talked about per se laws. In other words, we're going to stick you if we can find evidence that you have smoked marijuana. We're not going to have to prove that you're actually impaired. And that's the big move in DUI laws in recent years. It should be called NDUI laws, non-driving under the influence laws.
And how much education do lawmakers need to take these steps? It takes a lot of medical science to go from seeing someone falling down drunk to determining trace amounts of a drug metabolite in their body.
They have been assured by a variety of ONDCP type persons and other opponents of marijuana normalization that, no, you don't have to worry about that. We'll tell you what to do. We'll get the laboratories. They'll give you a number, and if the individual has a concentration in his, usually in his blood, occasionally in his urine, higher than that number, you may assume that they are impaired. And my guess is, although there's some good arguments going on in state legislators, and they're good witnesses, most of the time the legislators are not being stretched. They're just being told, listen, it's hard to show intoxication, but we all know that this individual is a drug user and probably a bad driver. In fact, there's a significant invocation of prejudice here. That is, here is a person who has used a drug and then gotten in his car while he still has the drug and some traces of it in his bloodstream, and I bet he's a bad person and a bad driver.
Now, and Dr. Morgan, aren't people prescribed medications on a prescription basis every day, especially those in our aging population in America that we talk so much about with prescription care? Aren't there a lot of prescription medications that wouldn't make you sort of top on your game behind the wheel?
The best approach is that of a Dutch scientist who did a series of studies of prescription drugs and over-the-counter drugs and marijuana and alcohol. And what he had was a device on the car which showed that you were having a little bit of trouble staying in the middle of the road, you know, staying in between the white lines. And he showed that almost any drug that humans take at a reasonable dose will have some impact. In truth, I sound like an apologist, marijuana had the least impact. It had less impact than antihistamines. it had less impact of alcohol, far under the legal limits of intoxication, and some other prescription drugs such as opiates, and antidepressants also cause people to weave a little bit. Now, this doesn't mean this individual is going to cause a wreck. It doesn't mean he can't get home, but it means he has some degree of inability to exert all his skills while driving. And as I said, antihistamines were worse than marijuana in his studies.
Now let's talk about cannabis further. There have been some European traffic safety studies involving cannabis intoxication. So what's the science tell us here? Does cannabis affect our driving ability?
It does not affect driving ability as much as alcohol. Under all circumstances of dosing and all circumstances of driving, alcohol is a much more impairing drug. One of the reasons, quite clear, is that alcohol makes us take risks. It removes our risk-aversive good sense. You're driving along, you're a little bit high on alcohol, and you say, oh, hell, I can pass that car. I can make this turn at 45 miles an hour. When in reality, if you were sober, you would not try it. Now, cannabis, while under certain circumstances, as I said, can impair driving ability, does not make people risk takers. In fact, if anything, as you may have heard, it works the other way, that in many studies, particularly in the Dutch studies that I like to refer to, the cannabis driver doesn't feel like driving because he's high. And then when you tell him, follow that car ahead and get within five car lengths of it, he'll say, I can't do that. I refuse to do that. It's too close. Or you say, okay, now I want you to pass going up the hill here. You've got enough clearance. And the cannabis driver will often say or will often protest, I don't feel that I have enough clearance. I don't want to make your audience think that cannabis makes everybody a more careful driver, but in some studies that's exactly what happened. The cannabis driver becomes concerned and actually slows down and drives in a more careful fashion, while the alcohol driver, even at low doses, starts gaily taking risks and being a foolish driver.
So there must be some moderation here. Just like alcohol, we likely want to set limits on, say, how intoxicated you are behind the wheel. So how would we test for that? And has anyone out there set levels to say what's safe and what's not?
No, no one has set levels. And it's very difficult to make that assessment. one of the things that, again, were done in the studies at Maastricht is that the individual would say, I feel I cannot drive, and then they would persuade him to drive. And have someone evaluate his driving, and the evaluator would find nothing wrong, while in reality the dose of cannabis was high enough to give him appreciable levels, including blood levels above, let's say, 100 nanograms per ml of blood. Now, the important thing to remember in all of the careful Dutch studies is that the cannabis driver who appears to represent little risk to us is an experienced cannabis user. In the United States, it's almost impossible to do studies on naive people, people who have not smoked cannabis before. In Holland, a number of people who had never smoked marijuana before but who were said, well, I'm going to pretty soon anyway, were then they were given a standard dose to smoke, and they became bad drivers, really seriously bad drivers, just as bad as alcoholics. So I don't want to scare people, but the issue for us is the problematic driver is the driver who drives while inexperienced. Driving under inexperience would be a good term, that kind of DUI. Now, fortunately, most cannabis users, even those who decide to go ahead and drive, have experience of the feeling of being high and can adjust for it. The dilemma for these naive users is that they cannot adjust. And the question you've asked me, I'm so sorry I can't answer for you. Leo Hollister many years ago found some people that he could not detect as intoxicated who had well over 100 nanograms, some of them 200, 300 nanograms per ml in their blood, which is a very high level. But they were experienced users and somewhat resistant to the effect, and they had no impairment, while other people at 85 nanograms per ml who didn't have much experience were impaired. So the dilemma for us is that people are clamoring for reasonable blood levels or reasonable urine levels, and it's hard for us to give them that. I would point out that we have all agreed to accept a certain alcohol level as indicative of intoxication. It is generally indicative of intoxication, but you, surely you and all your listeners are aware that there are people at 0.08 who are not driving too badly. And in fact, there are people at 0.04 who are driving very badly. But we've decided that alcohol is such a monster problem, we're going to have to make arbitrary decisions. And so let's take 0.08, at which most people are impaired.
This is fascinating, Dr. Morgan. So there is something to this in asking inexperienced marijuana smokers not to drive at all.
You may not feel it enough, your impaired driving, so you must have someone to help you. And the dilemma, well, let me say this. This is what I'd love to say, and this is what my my co-author Lynn Zimmer, who unfortunately died just a couple months ago, she always used to say, what we should do is give them the official government agency, a per se level. Go ahead, take one. We'll say if someone has more than 5 in his blood, 5 nanograms per ml in his blood, that's it. He's convicted. But at the same time, the trade-off is we legalize marijuana. I'm willing to give these people what they want, which is a per se level, but what they should do is give us the same thing that they've had to give us for alcohol, that people will no longer be arrested for the possession and use of small amounts of marijuana.
And so if this trade-off happened, if this decision were to be taken up tomorrow, even say locally in a municipality, how would that local law enforcement agency or police force deal with it?
A sort of approach. I'm worried about it because police have gained prestige by taking courses and labeling themselves experts. But if an individual is driving in an impaired fashion and the police pulls him over because he doesn't stop for the stop sign or he's speeding too fast in an urban area, I would give at that moment the policeman the right to assess the individual, and if he's assessed as impaired, then I give him the right to draw the blood. And we can't do urine because an individual will smoke a joint and be positive for 36 hours. So we can't just collect urine and give them a per se level on urine. So we're going to have to, I'm calling for something quite radical here. I'm saying that people are going to lose their presumption of innocence if the policeman assesses that they're driving impaired. And then if they have a blood level above 5 nanograms per ml, they are guilty of driving under the something or other, whether we call it under the influence or not. And I'm willing to give them that if they'll give me legalized marijuana.
And what about the saliva testing, the oral fluid testing that they use in Australia and now using in the UK?
What happened in the early studies was that the saliva test became positive very quickly after smoking, and it had to do with some cannabinoid sticking to the tissue inside the mouth, sticking to the buccal mucosa. But my feeling right now, and the last review I've read, is that it isn't good enough. There are too many false positives and false negatives. And the real, I'm really concerned about saying to you and your audience that I'm proposing a plan in which somebody gets to put a needle in your arm, but I don't see any choice. Urine won't do it. Saliva won't do it. Maybe someday technology will make it possible to assess a cannabis concentration that we can rely on. But I would repeat again that most experienced users will not have trouble under this because they won't be pulled over. I don't want them to smoke. I don't want anybody to smoke and drive. But if you're an experienced user and you smoke a little bit and drive, and your wife has smoked much more and had too many drinks, and so you decide you're going to drive the two of you home, you will probably be okay, although I don't want you to do it. But that's the issue here, that if you're experienced, you're not going to get pulled over by the police because you'll be driving okay. The old joke in the Cheech and Chong routine was you can always tell the pot smoker because he's driving 7 miles an hour following the Cheetos truck. And the joke is not real good, but good enough, because some marijuana users will drive quite slowly when they're high.
Dr. Morgan, I want to thank you so much again for joining us today, and I look forward to speaking with you in the future.
I had a good time. Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Dr. John P. Morgan is Professor Emeritus of Pharmacology at City University of New York, a member of NORML's Advisory Board, and co-author with Lynn Zimmer of Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts. We have links to the book at normalaudio-com. And find out more about DUI on NORML's website, norml.org. This has been NORML's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Thanks to podshow.com for all the great pod-safe music. We feature the band Carne Cruda as our theme. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. Thanks to Red Aphid Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. The podcasting technology of NORML is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.